You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On May 12, 2013, 48-year-old Vicki Isaac of rural Puxico, Missouri, a woman with a history of learning disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and drug addiction, loaded a .22 caliber handgun and shot her violent addict husband while he slept in the trailer they shared with Vicki's adult son. Or did she? According to police reports, Vicki called 911 and confessed to the crime. Was this another sad case of murder amongst addicts or something more? Betty Frizzell escaped her family's legacy of crime, addiction, and abuse to become a respected law enforcement officer and teacher. Drawn back to the town and people of her past, Betty works to uncover the truth of murder and her family's history of violence. Her investigation uncovers sad realities about mental illness, small-town politics, and a society that doesn't care about poor white trash. There are never easy answers when the odds are stacked against you and no amount of elegies will save your family. The book that we're featuring this evening is If You Can't Quit Crying, You Can't Come Here No More, A Family's Legacy of Poverty, Crime, and Mental Illness in Rural America, with my special guest, author Betty Frizzell. Thank you very much for this interview, and thank you and welcome to the program, Betty Frizzell.
Well, thank you for having me, Dan.
Thank you so much. This is, again, a very, very fascinating and heart-wrenching personal story. Let's get to telling us, our audience, a little bit about Poplar Bluff, Missouri, and your life growing up with your extended, well, with your numerous siblings. So tell us a little bit about your life in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, but yes, tell us about your early life.
Yeah, well, Poplar Bluff is a town of about 17,000. It's located on the Arkansas border of Missouri. That's why I have the beautiful accent I have, but yeah, it's a small town, and it's got everyone knows everybody, and it's right on the Black River. It's a rural area where the primary income is factories or the hospitals or farming, and it's what you would consider just a nice, normal, American, laid-back little country town. And I grew up on primarily on the east side of Poplar Bluff, which was the lower income side. Back in the 60s and the 50s, it had a red light district because it was a major railroad stop between St. Louis and Memphis. So you would have people coming from both of those areas stopping in Poplar Bluff and then going on about their business back up to St. Louis or Memphis. And we grew up in a the low income side, and there was a lot of government housing, though we didn't live in that. That side was always considered the lower income part of the city.
You talk about, you write that murder was generational in your family. You say they were known for musical talent and quick tempers, but there was much more to this murderous bent in your family. Tell us, as you write in the book, some of the things that you grew up hearing about the murderous past of some of family members.
Well, it was generational. As far back as I can go, records weren't kept that really that great, but it started as far as my great-grandfather was a murderer, my grandmother, and then my mother, and then I have two sisters that have been accused, and one is currently incarcerated for life. So growing up, we expected someone to go to jail, and that was just a part of it because they were very creative people, and with creativity sometimes comes substance abuse and other things, and untreated mental illness, because you didn't talk about mental illness where I come from. That's, you don't talk about it. Just keep it to yourself, because that's what, you know, my mom had always wanted. Anything that happened in the house stayed in the house. So when we knew that the family had, my uncle had killed his granddaughter, and my I have another cousin that had faked his death. So we knew that everybody was in the criminal justice system. I knew more about bail bonding probably than most kids knew before I got to elementary school and things like that. But by the time I came along, I was the eighth of eight children. And by the time I'd come along, my mom had me later in life. So she was a different person than maybe my oldest sister. So I was always on that church bus going to church, and she would put me in, like, Girl Scouts, and I was a safety patrol officer, and she would just to keep me occupied and away from the house. So I was exposed to different people and different lifestyles than I had grew up in. So I knew myself, I had developed at a young age a form of OCD of moral scrupulosity, which meant that there was a black and a white thing. There was a right and there was a wrong. And then with that coupled with the church that I went to, I knew that to hurt people was bad. And I knew that the things that my family did were bad. But I was going to not be them. I decided, I was going to live a different life, because I was exposed to different things more than my other sisters, because there's 21 years difference between me and my oldest sister. Mm-hmm. I have a niece that's actually 3 days younger than me. So my mom was a totally different person by the time I came along. She had got her diabetes had taken over, and she'd gotten sick. I remember some of the things that she did when I was younger, and some of the stuff that she got me into. I found out was that, and I talk about this in the book, how she had me go with her to get get another driver's license in a different name.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was a good cover having this kid with her. But I had determined it along, and I look at my mental health conditions as a superpower in a way, because it saved me from falling into the traps that maybe my other siblings did fall into.
You write about that of all the sisters, you were closest to Vicky. And Vicky,
right. You
write of instances where she protected you, and it seemed like she could take a beating, and said that at
mm-hmm.
one point that she had taken a beating because she could take this beating. What were some of the things that Vicky, you were considered the smart one and the gifted one by virtue of your mother, but what was Vicky considered, and what was her behavior like growing up, and what, as a result,
Vicky,
did she receive?
Yeah, Vicky has always had a diminished intellect, but she's always been tough. You know, she was always, that was her cover from the abuse that we suffered from. My mother had an alcohol problem and a prescription pill problem. And Vicky always, that was her thing. She didn't have the intellect to deal with the coping mechanisms that maybe I had. But she's closest to me in age. She's the seventh of eight children. And but she would make up for it by being athletic, and she tried really hard to sing, be in choir and things like that. But Vicky was the literal whipping boy in our family. I think it might have been because we don't even know who Vicky's father is. There's five different fathers that we know of the eight children. And I didn't know who my own father was until I was 36 and went on Ancestry.com and found who my real father was. So, and it's really funny because when I found my real father, you want to talk about DNA, I found my real father, his family has a lot of law enforcement in it, which I think that's where I got mine at. But with Vicky, she was the literal whipping boy for the family. She, it was that scene that you're talking about, was very hard to write, but it was, I was a cop. I had cop mentality that, she did this crime, I'm done. I washed my hands of her. She can do the time. That was the thing. But then I had this dream, and I remember being like four, and this horrific beating that I was taking from my mom for leaving a toy out. And Vicky jumped in the middle of it and took the beating for me. And I asked her, you know, why did you do this? And she said, I don't know. I probably deserved it. Well, she didn't deserve it. She didn't deserve a lot of things that happened in her life. But as you grow up with children who are abused and neglected and things like that, you seem to think that the abuse that you took was your fault. You did something. You must have caused it. And, you know, you're a keeper of secrets. So that's what we always, you know, never went to school and told anybody or anything, because this was the late 70s and early 80s that Vicky was going to school. And it just seems like mom was her first abuser. And then as she grew older, the school, you know, we were in the rural South. You know, we consider ourselves Southern, not Midwestern, which a lot of people think Missouri is Midwestern, but parts of Missouri are very Southern, especially where I grew up at. And they still use corporal punishment. So then she was spanked at school. So she was, the only thing she knew about her behavior, because she couldn't correct it, was abuse and violence. So as she got into romantic relationships, you know, as a teenager and a young adult, that was what she looked for, was that chaotic, abusive thing, because that was the norm to her. You know, a lot of people read the book and they go, well, this is really traumatic. No, that was Tuesday in our house. You know, we didn't know it was traumatic. Yeah. It was just what happened. And then as she got older, you know, she gets in the criminal justice system starts, you know, she gets pulled over. She starts getting in that system. So abuse is the only answer she knew to herself. I felt kind of dumb, you know, even though I supposedly have more intellect or whatever. I felt dumb because I didn't understand. My sister was a victim. She wasn't a person that made bad choices. That's what I saw her as. But then as I got older, and after her arrest, I was like, she really was a victim. You know, thinking back, you know, mom was her first abuser, then the school, then the criminal justice system, and now, you know, all the romances. I've never known of her having a romance that she didn't have a black eye or a bloody lip or something. And she said something really poignant to me the other day. I recently got remarried, and she said, you know, your husband's a very nice man. And I said, yeah, he is. And she said, your ex-husband was a very nice man. And I said, yeah, he is too. And she said, you always get nice men. I've never been with a nice man. And I thought, oh, my gosh, you haven't. So
you talk about the relationship with your mother and Vicky, and was never good and was abusive, and but it wasn't. It was worse when she was pregnant. I believe at 18 mm-hmm. years age. What were the kinds of things your mother told Vicky about herself, and as a result, she believed?
Well, that she was never going to be a good mom. She didn't know. She had no right to have a kid. She didn't know what she wouldn't know what to do. She was unfit. She didn't know how to take care of them. And then after she had the child, which she was married, and then her and her husband went through a divorce because of domestic violence, because he had been abusive to her, and she came home in the middle of the night with the child. Mom took the child over and basically told her, you don't need to have this child. You know, you don't know what you're doing. And that was the thing. But Vicky always had this intense devotion to my mom, which I didn't. I think it was my church going and being exposed to different lifestyles that I didn't have this intense devotion, even though I did. And I you know, she'd always made me do this, you know, I promised her to take care of Vicky or promised her to take care of everyone else. But Vicky, you know, was the literal whipping boy that mom always told her that she was never no good and she would never amount to nothing and she was just going to always be the way she is, and she's never going to have anything in life. But Vicky had such an intense devotion to her, and I didn't have that. I mean, and my mother siblings didn't, but you do in a sense, you know, because my mom was such a striking person that the world revolved around her. She was the sun, and you revolved around her. And you were pulled into her gravitational pull a lot because she was very charming, but she was also very intimidating too.
You talk about that mom had a gun, and this will be important later, a .22 handgun, mm-hmm. but also that you guys survived off of hunting and wild game and foraging for food and a big garden. So tell us about you and your mother and Vicky acquiring these hunting skills and comfortable around a gun.
Well, I always like to tell say that I always had a gun before I had a Barbie doll, because that's the way we were raised. A gun, and for people who live in the country, is like a washing machine. It's another necessary tool. And so Mom always had, we always had guns around the house, and Mom was a NRA gun, a card-carrying member. But we would go out and, shoot, or we would go hungry, because my mom refused to get on government assistance. She didn't want them in her business. She, little less interference with the government of what she was doing was good for her. So I acquired those skills before I even got to grade school. And Vicky was, had taught me how to go out and shoot, and taught me how to look for food, and we'd go deer hunting. And in the school that we went to, they would let you out for the 2 weeks for deer season when it was again. And so that's, everybody had guns. Kids came to school with the guns on the rack of their truck. But that's how we survived, because, Mom, what jobs she did have, in the late 70s, early 80s, were minimum wage. And she had all these kids left home. There were five of us left at home after her last husband died. So we had to make do with what we had. So Mom had grown up in the country. She knew how to live off the land. She had a green thumb. She could throw seeds in the garden, and it would grow a beautiful big garden, and we would go pick wild berries. But, having a firearm was just another thing of survival. It wasn't like – it's like having a washing machine, as close as I can tell you, to what other people would know what it was about.
Mm-hmm. Let's just stop for a second for these commercial breaks. Now, you growing up, like you say, you had this, you knew nothing but violence. You didn't know who your father was. Vicky didn't know who her father was. This was, you knew nothing, you write, you knew nothing but chaos. You thought that was normal. Poverty, chaos, violence. So Vicky headed down a certain path that was different than yours. Tell us what your path was. And what you became.
I had thought, I'm getting out of here. If I have kids, I didn't even know if I wanted kids, because, coming from so many siblings, how hard it is to take care of them. I said, I'm not going to do this. And, having the OCD of moral scrupulosity, there's a black and there's a white, there's a good and a bad. So I wanted to be good, and I would work so hard to be good. And do the right things and not lie and things. So naturally, I gravitated towards law enforcement, which a lot of people in my family didn't like when I went into it. They were like, oh, you want to be so different than us, you just want to. My brother even refused to come to Thanksgiving because he didn't want to eat with someone who was a police officer. So I wanted that because I knew I could bring a different perspective to law enforcement. I didn't know how different it was because of my upbringing, I had a sheriff one time call me in his office and said, Betty, how did you figure this out? And I said, are you kidding me? My mom was doing this when I was 7 years old. My mom had pulled these kind of scams, so I get it. So it's a different perspective and of what I could bring to law enforcement. And I enjoyed a very, really good career. I was law enforcement officer of the year, and I was promoted very quickly to detective. And I still do investigations. So I had those unique life experiences that I thought were just everyday. I thought everybody had these kind of life, even being exposed to other lifestyles. I thought, well, they all know that you can go get another driver's license, if you do this. No, a lot of people don't know that. And I think that's why I wanted to uphold, and be a law enforcement officer and to help those people like myself that were – you can't help what you're born into. And but I always find, even when I was out as a police officer, I would find there's always one person in the family that can, that is a shining star, and they can rise above. But, you always bring that stuff in to your life. Like, I married a man that gave me a very calm loving existence. And that wasn't something I was used to. I wanted that chaos. You know, I wanted that. I wasn't used to it. So I had to work really hard of, am I really getting mad because I want to get, or am I just getting mad because I want to get mad? Because, you know, you don't come out of hell without having a few scars. And that's what I was raised in, was that literal hell of domestic violence. And I didn't know, at 2:45 every day I would start shaking because I didn't know who I was coming home to. Was my mom going to be the nice mom that's going to cook dinner, or is she going to be the angry mom that's going to look for a reason to hit me? You know, that's, you didn't know who you were coming home to. So as an adult, even when I got into a nice, quote-unquote, normal life and became a police officer and I was doing all these great things at work, I would come home and still think, well, and I had to stop myself. And thank God my first husband was very good about telling me, are you getting mad because you want to get mad, or are you getting mad because you're really mad? And I was like, thank you, because I needed that checks and balances because I didn't know any different.
Tell us about in 2012, Vicky's situation. Where was she and where were you located? And also tell us about her son, Kenny.
Okay. Vicky was down in Puxico, which is a little tiny town of about 800 people, about 20 miles from Poplar Bluff. And I was in St. Louis. I was teaching in North St. Louis and teaching the university level and at the high school level. I was teaching right outside of Ferguson. This is right before the Ferguson unrest. And Vicky's son had came off. He had been a merchant marine, and Kenny is the son that my mom raised, and him and Vicky always have had a tumultuous relationship. It's not, it was never good, and he never really considered her his mom. She was just a person that was there in his life. My mom was more of his caregiver, and he had come off the riverboat. We didn't understand, and he had gotten evicted from his house. We didn't understand that either, because he was really good about paying his bills, and my mom had left him with a little, you know, financially stable and everything. So we didn't really understand how the, why this was going on. But I was 150 miles away in St. Louis, and Vicky suffered a stroke. She had a hemorrhagic stroke, which left her with bleeding on the brain. And she was airlifted from Puxico to St. Louis and died on the way there, but they brought her back. And so she got out of the hospital and was at home recuperating when Kenny gets evicted and has to move in with her and her husband.
Mm-hmm. Now tell us about Chris Isaacs and how Vicky and Chris met.
Okay. They were both in the wrestling circuit, like the traveling wrestling circuit, like they did the WWE type wrestling. Mm-hmm. So, Vicky had always been interested in that. My mom had been interested in that. And that was one of the few times that my mom, my sister would, my mom would show pride in Vicky when she was wrestling. But Chris had been wrestling for a while. His family owned a wrestling company, and he was like an Arkansas tag team champion. He'd held a belt for a while. And they were, sometimes it seemed like he couldn't distinguish between what was scripted in the wrestling ring and what was real life. There was one incident where we were in a hotel room with my former husband, and he tried to just start like a fight with my husband for no reason. And it was it just seemed like something off of a wrestling script. And he would be like that. He would have these bouts of violence. And looking back now, I don't know how much of that, you know, it's scripted, but yet how much of that physical stuff it can impact the brain, like if concussions that aren't detected and things like that, because we see that with football players. And but he had a history of violence as well. So, but him and Vicky, you know, for the most part, the first few years of their marriage, it was good for both of them because they had this shared common interest in wrestling, and they love the sport. They love the, going out and meeting the people and things like that. So the first few years were very good for both of them. It was just after the stroke, Vicky couldn't keep up with things, and Chris and her both had gotten into opioids because he was in constant pain from his years of wrestling. He had broken his ankle in a wrestling accident, and And so he started going to these pain management clinics, and she did too. And to treat, they're both, you know, had mental health conditions, and the doctors were giving them opioids instead of other psychotropic things that maybe could have helped them with their mental health.
Right. Throughout this relationship that she had with Chris, and then when Kenny comes to live with them,
mm-hmm.
You are the person in St. Louis that's fielding the calls from Vicky in a panic, telling you things, some real, some not so real, and then you
mm-hmm.
are the person that's calling police services to check on her welfare.
Right.
Tell us just some of the calls that, what were they were characterized by? What were some of these calls about? What were some of Vicky's claims?
Well, Vicky was claiming that he was taking her medicine, of course, and in his autopsy, he does have her Restrel and her Xanax in his system. She was claiming that the clock was talking to her on the wall, and that our mother was coming to visit her, and that Chris had got this guy come from another country or something, and then was going to kill her, and if she didn't give him her medicine. And then I would hear him, you know, cussing her in the background, and they were just fighting back and forth. So I would call law enforcement because, you know, that's I'm very fluent in how to speak to police. And this was a small rural community that didn't have resources, and the law enforcement there was basically, you know, they were elected, which is an issue. And so if you're an elected official in a town of 800 people, you're not going to rock the boat of, because Chris also came from a family of eight. So there's only 21,000 people in this whole county. So they're related to somebody somewhere something. And the police officer I would talk to, you know, officer to officer, professional courtesy, can you go over there and just see if they're okay? And he would, and then sometimes he would say, oh, it's just Chris being Chris, and he's just acting on, and that's just the way he acts. And so it got to the point where I'd called the police so much that they got really frustrated with me, but I'm like, no, this is domestic violence. They need to be separated. And then you throw another person who has a mental health condition that's living with schizophrenia into the mix, into this opioid-induced mental health condition, chaotic family, and you've got a recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened when Kenny moved in.
Yeah, you talk about Kenny moving in, but just after a few weeks of being there, there
mm-hmm.
is a call, and he is tell us where this call leads to in terms of with Kenny and from this apartment and that interaction.
Okay, he had called 911 and said, you need to come over here and arrest me because I'm going to kill her and him, and then I'm going to kill myself. And they come over, the police officers take him to the psychiatric ward. We didn't know Kenny had schizophrenia. This is the thing. Kenny had been out on the riverboat working. He worked 30 days and off 30 days, or sometimes he would work 6 months and then stay off 6 months. So we were 150 miles away. We didn't understand it because we knew he had, you know, some learning disabilities, but he was always kind of eccentric, and that's my mom was kind of eccentric as well. So
right.
We, you know, some of his behaviors we attributed to that and drinking. You know, he got to drinking after mom died, and he hid his diagnosis from us for years, because he was diagnosed at 23. Now, fast forward ahead, he's in his 30s. He's living with Vicky and her husband. So when he was on his medication, he was fine. He was a functional person, but when he wasn't, that's when, and then he had just decided to take himself off the medication. So he had called 911 and said, you need to come get me because I'm going to murder him and her, and then I'm going to murder myself.
And so he was taken to the hospital, then he was
mm-hmm.
released from the hospital and returned back to the house. During this time and the preceding months before that, with all these calls, you have other sisters and other family. Did you make any calls concerning the situation with any other family members, and what was their reaction?
Absolutely, I did. I contacted every one of them, and my sisters who live, you know, farther in the South, I have one in Georgia, one in Louisiana, of the ones that, you know, are still alive and we still speak to each other, didn't want to get involved. They took that this is just their issue, you know, let them deal with it. You need to mind your business, stay out of it. You know, you're just being a nosy police officer, stay out of this. So my ex-husband and I, we talked to an attorney. We were going to get conservatorship of Vicky. But it was a very taxing thing to do. I know it's been in the news a lot with Britney Spears and her conservatorship. Mm. But for the in Missouri, you actually have to, and especially her being married. She was legally married to this man, so that was another factor that we had to deal with, because he had way more rights than we ever would. And so in a sense, we were going to have to show that he was disabled and mentally incompetent to take care of her, and then we were going to have to serve her. So it was going to be, and the attorney told us this is not an easy process, and this is a long, arduous process. When you take someone's rights away and you become a conservator, I had reserved myself that we're going to become her conservator, and or at least, you know, her guardianship of her. And so we were in that process, and then this alleged crime happened.
Yes. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages from our sponsor, which is ZocDoc. When you need a doctor, you need a doctor now. Not in a few days, not in a few weeks, and definitely not in a few months. If you need to see an MD as soon as possible, we've got a solution. Just download the free ZocDoc app, the easiest way to find a great doctor and instantly book an appointment. With ZocDoc, you can search for local doctors who take your insurance, read verified patient reviews, and book an appointment in person or video chat. Never wait on hold with a receptionist again. Whether you need a primary care physician, dentist, dermatologist, psychiatrist, eye doctor, or other specialist, Doc has you covered. Go to ZocDoc.com/truemurder and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free. Every month, millions of people use ZocDoc, and I'm one of them. It's my go-to whenever I need to see a doctor. ZocDoc is great. You should try it. ZocDoc makes healthcare easy. Now is the time to prioritize your health. Go to ZocDoc.com/truemurder and download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free and book a top-rated doctor. Many are available as soon as today. That's ZocDoc.com/truemurder. Now, Betty, we were talking about just previous to May 12, 2013. You say that your sister didn't use social media or texting, and so their communication between you was phone calls primarily. You called your sister, and her son, Kenny, answered the phone. Tell us about this incredible, fateful conversation and what he said to you and what you found out.
Well, she hadn't called all day, and that was unusual for Vicky, because since she'd had the stroke, she called numerous times a day. And it was 10 o'clock at night, and I was like, why isn't she called? So I called her, and he answers the phone, and he says, I said, well, where's Vicky? He goes, she's in Stoddard County Jail, and that's the jail there in Puxco. It's actually in Bloomfield, Missouri. And I said, what is she in jail for? And he said, she killed Chris. And I couldn't believe it. I was floored. I heard the words, but I didn't want to believe the words as they came out. And so I'm scrambling to get the number for the jail to call to see if this is true, because I thought maybe this was just a cruel joke that he was playing and didn't want to give me the phone to Vicky. And they said, yes, she's here with no bond warrant, first degree murder. And I'm like, oh my gosh, how many more murderers are we going to have in this family? And going back a little bit, this was 5 days after Kenny does that fateful 911 call and says that he's going to kill him and then himself. So he's been in the psychiatric ward for 3 days, 2 days after he gets out of the psychiatric ward, now we've got a dead body.
You, as a police officer, immediately think like a police officer, regardless of whether this is your family or not. And that's your instincts. What did you initially see as problematic with the handling of this case involving your family?
I just couldn't see Vicky doing that because, you know, I looked at the mugshot and that wasn't her face. That was just the person living in her body. That was not the sister I knew, the one that loved animals and loved little kids and older people. That wasn't her. This wasn't the yard sale going, puzzle putting together sister I had. So it was like she was in total shock. Like this, the whole, her whole body was gone. Then there was just this empty shell that was living there. And I'm 5 days prior, we get a 911 call that someone's saying that they want to kill someone. And then we have a dead body. There's three people in this house and one of them's dead now. There's two logical solutions, you know, was it Vicky or was it Kenny? And the way I'm not contacted as soon as she's arrested, that's a problem because they know the criminal justice system is what I've done my whole adult life. That's, that, you know, I've given my heart and soul. I teach it. You know, I was teaching in Ferguson, and this was right before the Ferguson unrest. And I was dealing with, you know, I see kids get their rights taken away and violated every day. Why wasn't I contacted as soon as she was arrested? You know, and I didn't understand why Kenny didn't contact me because they all know that I take great pride in my work that I did. And I try to educate myself on every aspect of the criminal justice system. And I just didn't understand that. So that was the first red flag. And then Kenny, you know, he'd been home for hours and didn't contact me. And, you know, she didn't contact me. That's fine because she's, you know, who knows if they only allowed her one call or not. So, just 5 days, you've got someone saying I'm going to kill him and her and then myself and now that. And I knew Vicky is, you know, she might have not lived a Christ-like life, but I knew that her faith was very important to her. Her beliefs were very important, so I couldn't see her doing this because her and I had had conversations as young adults and as children about, you know, about the Bible and about things, and it said in the probable cause statement that she was going to kill herself. Now, that was one thing I could not believe because if, you know, in our belief, if you kill yourself, you're going to go to hell. So she would never see mom again. She was so devoted to mom. I couldn't see her killing herself because she, you know, always thought mom went to heaven because mom, you know, repented right before she died and things like that. So I didn't think that she would, that would give up her chance to see her beloved mother again. So that stuff just didn't, I had to take all the emotion out of it and think like a cop. You know, it was like, there's something ain't right. This just ain't right. This doesn't make any sense to me.
Let's go back just a bit to talk about what initially, you learn more as time goes on, but initially when you talked to Kenny, you asked him the conditions of this murder, what happened. So what were the things that he told you he was doing and he heard and he did?
He told us that he had been up that morning. He was the only, everybody else was sleeping. Chris was sleeping on the couch. Vicky was sleeping in her bedroom. And he had went to the store and bought some lottery tickets and some tobacco, I think, for him, and came back and went to bed. He's woke up by the shot being fired. Now, this is a trailer. This isn't a house. It's a tiny trailer. And as soon as one bullet goes off, it's like a cannon in there, like a rocket's going off. It took, and Kenny's a very light sleeper because that's the way our family is, because you just, when you deal with my mom, you had to be a light sleeper because you didn't know, you know, to get up when she told you to get up. So Kenny is a light sleeper like I am. And that it took him six shots. There was 10 shots fired because there was at the autopsy. So he said he heard six rounds go off. So at that time, she would have had to go back and reload. And it just didn't make any sense. It took six shots to get you up in this tiny little trailer. That would have been like a rocket going off in there. Nobody could have slept through that, especially a light sleeper like he and I, like we are. And he jumped up and he saw her. She was going back to reload the gun again and then shoot herself, but he took the gun away from her. And I something just didn't sound right, because especially him not waking up with the first shot being fired, because it's a tin can. You're shooting a gun into a tin can, and the trailers are just nothing but wooden paneling and tin. It's basically all this was. It was an older trailer, and he's just and it's only like two bedrooms, and those are tiny little bedrooms. And I just his story didn't ring true to me. It just I had a lot of problems with it. And the fact that he was just being really not wanting to talk to me, not wanting to tell me everything. So I made time to go down there and see him. And I used the excuse that they needed an air conditioner to go down there and to actually get into the crime scene.
Right. And you said your purpose was to go there and put this air conditioner in, but also to be able to ask him if you could, to find out if there was any more information, because you were – at that point, very suspicious that he had killed Chris and that your sister had. Well, tell us what you thought initially before we will find out later what you deduced. But what did you initially think had happened rather than what Kenny had said?
I thought that he had done this. And I thought that he had been involved way more than what he was putting on. Because he was just being too different in his behavior. He wasn't his usual jovial self. He was just being very evasive to me and not talking his speech patterns were kind of different. And when I tried to get to the nitty gritty of what the actual what he saw that morning, he was very elusive and. So I'm thinking he's way more involved in this than what is going on. So I arrived down there and under the guise of putting this air conditioner in, because it's Missouri heat. It's hot, sticky heat. You can see it. It's so hot you can breathe it and feel it. And it was getting hot in the trailer. It's just like a hot tin box without a trailer, without an air conditioner. So I'm measuring out the window, and I'm trying to throw questions at him. And what he's telling me isn't making any sense. He makes this big thing about these gloves. He keeps talking about how the sheriff's department had him clean up the crime scene afterwards with these gloves. And I'm thinking, these are some cheap gloves. There's no way I would give my officers these gloves, because there's a liability issue, especially with fentanyl and other things that you can get on you and any kind of contagious or biohazards you can get on you. And but he made this big deal about these gloves, and then he would put them back down. And as I looked through later on, I he said he was sleeping. Kenny was really meticulous about not having wrinkles in his clothes. And he said he was laying down and he got back up. And then I looked at the photos from Vicky's case file. He's in wrinkled, crumpled clothes. It looked like they came from the dirty clothes. I don't think those were the clothes he had on. And Kenny would buy the same a pair of clothes for everything. He would have like four shirts that were the same and four pairs of pants that were the same, and he'd wear those out, and then he'd try something new. He had patterns. It was part of his mental health condition. He had patterns that he would stay in, and that was part of my mom too. My mom would keep him in the same type of clothes, and then he would change them out. But it was just one jive in with me. I had that instinct that this isn't the whole story, and I want to talk to my sister.
You got to talk to your sister, and you asked her plain out, flat out. But before this, it's very interesting. You write that when you talked to your sister sometime before that, she didn't even know what she was charged for. She didn't realize she was charged for the murder. She said, "What?" And so let's talk about this confession. What does she say in that confession?
She said that something told her to get up and to end him and then end herself. And it's a very arduous process to talk to somebody that's in jail, especially someone, we don't remember numbers no more. Everybody's got our numbers all in their phone, right? We don't remember what, so I had to send her a letter to get her to call me. So this is weeks after, okay, I sent her a letter, and then a few days after that, then she, you know, she can call me. So this is weeks after the murder. She talked to me, she said, Betty, why hasn't my husband, you know, Chris and Kenny came and got me out of jail? And I said, Vicki, you know why you're in jail, don't you? And she goes, I guess I had a DUI. I guess I got drunk and I hit somebody, because she had had numerous, and well, not numerous, but a couple of DUIs that she had went to jail for. And I said, Vicki, you're in jail for murder. And she goes, did I kill somebody in a car wreck? And I was like, no, you killed Chris, supposedly. Yeah. You supposedly confessed to it. And this is weeks after. So supposedly they take her in, the police, and she confesses right then. And she confessed on 911. We know that. But now weeks later, she doesn't even know where she's at. And she was taken aback that she thought she actually had a car wreck. So that is shock. She was in shock and somewhat denial, or you know, I can't say what was going on in her head, but that was another indicator to me that maybe she had witnessed something, you know, and then caused this, or was there when it went on and now. Because Vicky's mentality of being the whipping boy, like we talked about earlier, she would take the beatings for us girls and so that my mom would beat her instead of us. You know, that's one thing, she was kind of a protector of not just me, but my older sisters. And I could see her so easily falling into that role of thinking that I've been a bad mom my whole life. She always had that regret. She was a bad mom. And now my son's killed my husband, and now I have to take I'll take this charge. I've been to jail before. He hasn't. I could see her so easily falling into that role. That was what I was seeing. Knowing her past, knowing how her personality is, and knowing that 5 days before this murder that Kenny's calling and saying that. And as we were helping Kenny, because, you know, I took an interest in him, because I wanted, every good cop knows, you know, you can play good cop or bad cop. So I took a real interest in him and getting to know his care and helping him get care. So I thought, if he's going to disclose to him, maybe he'll disclose to a professional of what really happened that May morning. And coming to find out that he had been diagnosed for years with this mental health condition, never told anybody, which is his right, you know. He tells people that I had to quit my job at the marina, being a merchant marine, because I was going to hurt somebody, and I have homicidal ideation, and I think about this. All of this is in the background. And I'm thinking, man, if I could just get law enforcement to listen to me. But, again, you're talking about, you know, here I am. I'm in St. Louis. Most of my career is in St. Louis. So when I try to go and approach law enforcement down there to say, hey, take a look at this. You know, take a look. They did look at it. And I'm not going to say they didn't do an investigation. But there's other parts of this machine that haven't been inspected.
You talk about you asking Vicki flat out if she did this murder. What was that conversation like, and what did she say to you, and how did she act, and what was your conclusion?
This was the first time after she was convicted, and she took a plea deal and got life plus 25 years, which I don't know how that happens, but that's the state of Missouri. And I asked her, I said, you know, I know Kenny did this. And she said, no, I did this, and wouldn't look at me and give me she always will look you in the eye. One thing Vicki is, if she's truthful about, she would tell you, she's truthful about things, especially when she knows that she can't get the upper hand with me. And she knew that, you know, even though I'm her little sister, her younger sister, she knew that I don't play bull with her. She's going to tell me the truth. She wouldn't look me in the eye at all. She says, no.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, in my mind, I'm thinking, you're paying penance for being a bad mom. You're going to spend the rest of your life in this jail. She got life plus 25 years, and she's not eligible for parole till 2048.
Yeah.
And so, and then Kenny's whole other saga after what happens after, before she's convicted and then after she's convicted, Kenny's actions afterwards spoke volumes to me.
Mm-hmm. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. While this is going on, before she is sentenced, before the trial,
mm-hmm.
You have the arduous task of trying to take care of her. We talk about the conservatorship that you were trying to gain to be able to take care mm-hmm. of the finances and also to take care of Kenny as well. In this as well, you write about this strange thing in this small county where the Chris's family takes the vehicles that don't belong to them whatsoever, and despite you contacting law authorities about this, you still had to go get these vehicles from them. And so you had that to deal with, but you also had the idea that Kenny, you couldn't keep track of Kenny, even though you put him
right.
in a position where you could take care of him and take care of all of his needs. So tell us about what happens with trying to have Kenny go to the sentencing hearing of his mother. Tell us what happens.
Okay, so I had the county was against us. They're all elected. So when you're elected and there's only 21,000 people and he's also the youngest of eight, her alleged victim, somebody's related to somebody. So nobody wants to step on toes. So I knew we weren't going to get a fair deal. Even though she got a change of venue, it's still the same prosecutor, same judge. So I'm like, you know, and I was working in Ferguson at this time. You know, I was teaching policing in North St. Louis. So I'm having to deal with that at work and deal with it at home, people's rights and everything. So I was at one point, we had been paying Kenny's rent, and he finally got his Social Security through. So he was eligible to take care of his own finances. So he was doing good. He was on his meds. He was going to counseling. I'm still trying to get him to disclose. Right. I'm making sure he's staying in counseling and in psychiatric care, and maybe he'll disclose, because we're not at trial yet. We're maybe we got time, and I'm hopeful. And but, you know, I'm having to deal with this small county, and the Missouri doesn't have a slayer rule, which means if you cause the death, it doesn't mean you give up your own personal property. So I had to go to probate court to fight for my sister's legally owned property from his family
right.
in that county that they are all related and all friends with. So
yeah.
that was a part of it. And then Kenny slips away. Kenny disappears. And he starts talking as himself in an European accent. He starts referring to himself as August McDougal and these other European names. And then it comes time for Vicky's deposition. And he does the whole deposition in an European accent. And I'm thinking, man, we got to get conservatorship of him. But in Missouri, you have to serve the person personally. So we had an attorney that had helped us in the probate court and to do the paperwork for his conservatorship, because we knew we needed him off the street. But, you know, he has civil rights too. So you have to go through that arduous process again of going through the court system and proving that he has all these issues and stuff. So we were trying to get him served, and we had found him, and we had moved to Seattle at that time. I'd gotten a job and moved cross country to Seattle because it was taxing on my mental health, you know, having to deal with him and,
sure.
and her. And I lived in the Pacific Northwest, and that was always my peaceful place, so I wanted to go back. And I said, listen, we're flying in from Seattle. Meet us at the hotel, and we'll go to Vicky's sentencing. He says, sure. You know, he's fine. He calls me almost every day. And then we get down to go to the sentencing, which was December 2016, of 2016, December 15th, I believe. And we go into the courtroom, and she gets sentenced to life plus 25 years. Kenny's nowhere to be found. I can't find him anywhere. So there was my sister got really loud and because she felt like she had taken this plea deal because she thought she was going to get 25 years, and they gave the judge, who was friends with the alleged victim's family, gives her life plus 25 years.
Wow.
So she gets really upset, and so I told the prosecutor, we're going to appeal this. So the prosecutor goes to the media and says, you know, she's disappeared. I'm going to have her sister arrested for talking to me. So anyway, I'm live tweeting in Papa Bluff. I'm like, you know, if you know where my nephew is, find him. I searched up and down, and I had to go back to Seattle. So a month goes by, 2 months, and I said, listen, I'm going to have to put a missing person report out on. I thought maybe the alleged victim's family had done something to him because they're known to be, you know, like my family. And so I put a missing persons report out. The police knows me. He calls me, says, Betty, did you know he has a passport? And I said, there ain't no way in Hades he's got a passport because he can barely read or write. How did he get a passport? He goes, he's got a passport. I go, call Homeland Security. So he gets a hold of Homeland Security. We find out on the day Vicky's getting sentenced, he's on an airplane going to Rome, Italy. This is a person with a thick Southern accent. He's 6'6", covered in tattoos. Some of them say, God bless America, and he's going to Italy. And I'm thinking, what does he know in Italy? So I got a hold of the State Department, and they told me in the time from the sentencing to when we actually found he was in Italy, because who would have thought he was in Italy, he had gotten gangrene in his feet and had to have his feet amputated.
Wow.
And he was in a Rome hospital. And I was like, oh, my gosh. And he goes, listen, we'll take him to the airport. You just got to pay for the ticket back. So we found a ticket that would take him from Rome to Frankfurt, Germany, to Portland, to Seattle. Because I knew if I could get him here in Seattle, he's going to get top-rate care because they're very progressive in their mental health care out here. And I was like, okay, if you can get him on there. I had a guy waiting in Frankfurt to help him from one plane to the next. But we're under the assumption that he can't walk, because that's what he's telling them, that he can't walk. So he gets off. We were waiting for him in Seattle at SeaTac Airport, and he doesn't show up. And I'm like, what in the heck? So I called the cops, and the SeaTac Airport cops called Portland. They said, listen, Ms. Taylor, he has – that was my name, Taylor, at the time. He said he hasn't gotten on the plane in Frankfurt. He got off the plane and has never been seen. So I called, you know, Frankfurt, and they said, no, he walked off. We didn't know he could walk. The State Department in Italy didn't know he could walk. So he disappears and goes to Frankfurt, Germany. I didn't have a passport. My passport had expired. My husband didn't have one. We were on that plane going over there because it took us a while to get over there. And the Frankfurt police had already dealt with him. And they said that, you know, we can't kick him out of the country because we're a sanctuary country and, you know, he has so many opportunities. I'm like, okay, fine. They said, we haven't seen him in 6 months. I said, I'm going to find him because there's one thing I can do, and that's investigate. That's in my DNA is to be a police officer. I'm going to find him. I don't speak a lick of German, and I don't barely speak the English language. And I went out, I learned two phrases in German, and I went out and I asked every homeless person I could find. They were like, the police kept telling me, you know, Ms. Frizzell, don't go out there. You're going to get hurt. You're going to get hurt. I said, listen. I patrol some of the most dangerous places in the United States. I can do this. It's fine. Don't worry about me. And so I found it. They told me that he was there. They call him Rostruitz, which is big wheels in German. And he was in a wheelchair rolling around right outside of Kentucky Fried Chicken, which is a bit of irony because his father's family is from Kentucky Fried Chicken. I see him flying down the terminal down by the train station. I grabbed him. I said, Kenny, and he starts talking to me in German. And I said, you know, I had a picture of him and my son and my husband. And I said, this is you. And he goes, Julian, that's my son's name. And he goes, Aunt Betty, what are you doing here? And he starts talking perfect Southeast Missouri twang. And I said, you're getting on a plane and you're coming back to the United States with me. And he was like, oh, no. And then he started fighting. And then the German police, they go, is this your nephew? And I said, yes, this is my nephew. He goes, how did you find him in 3 days? I said, that's how we do police work in the United States, sir. Take him to the embassy. I want him gone. Because I was mad. I wanted him back on a plane. Because at this time, all the things he's doing, they're not the point of an innocent person. You know, these are – Why did you go to Italy? You didn't know anybody in Italy. He had told the authorities in Italy that he was there looking for his twin sister because the rest of his family died in a fire.
Yeah, jeez.
Now, and then
you
we
talk,
get him to go ahead.
Go ahead.
We get him to the embassy, and we can't get him back on the plane. And then that starts another court issue.
Yes, wow. at some point, you have a confrontation with Kenny. I know that he's not lucid and he's not, again, he's, you say schizophrenic, but the issue of whether he killed Chris, at least in this confrontation, came up. Tell us about this interaction and what he did say and what you said to him.
There was a short period before he escaped to Italy and then consequently Frankfurt. But he was homeless and evicted, and we had brought him up to the house because we were in every intention going to get him help. Because, you know, I'm very compassionate with mental health conditions because, you know, especially with Vicky and knowing what she goes through in the jail. So I had let him stay in the house, and he was doing his meds. He was doing great, and then he decided he was going to get himself off his meds. And I'm upstairs grading papers, and I can hear him down there having a conversation with his shoe. And he's getting angrier. He's getting angrier. And I went down there, and he gets into it with me and says that I know too much. I know way too much. And he goes, "You've known all along, haven't you? You've known." And I go, "Yeah, I know you killed Chris." And the words just hung out there in the air. And he says, "I know you just know too much." And I knew that we both, while those words hung in the air, that we both knew that he did this. And that's when my husband took him to the psychiatric ward, and we checked him in, and then he checked himself out. That's the revolving door that we ran into with him, was that we would get him the help when he'd get off his meds. You know, we can't force him to get his meds. And then he would get off his meds and stop, and then start medicating with alcohol or something else. And then the hallucinations would come and the voices would come. And, you know, he's always told me that August McDougal, this person that talks to him, doesn't like me because I know too much. So at that point, when those words were hanging in the air, right before my husband took him to the psychiatric ward, he looked at me like he was free. Part of him was free, you know, that that I had said it, and I had said it to him so he couldn't say it because he can't say it. But it was heartbreaking because then, you know, to be trapped in with a mental health condition and living like that, I always loved Kenny growing up. He was this little innocent child that didn't take care of him, couldn't take care of himself. He didn't learn his colors correctly, and potty training was a nightmare for my mom and I, because my mom and I were primarily his caregivers as I was a young girl. She came home with him when I was 13, so it was like I had a baby at 13 too, because my mom and I would take turns. Some nights my mom was an older lady. She was her body was wrecked with diabetes, and she was soon to be on dialysis, and her kidneys failed. That's how she died. But, you know, but she's got this baby, this toddler to take care of, especially a special needs toddler, because he was, he never met milestones like other kids. And then to see him grow up, and he was so happy and jovial. And then when he gets in his 20s, he's diagnosed with schizophrenia that we didn't know about. He was so ashamed to tell us. You know, that's the thing, we need to end the stigma with that, because people are so ashamed of that. But there's so many of us that live with mental health conditions. You know, and if that hadn't been there, I look at it this way. If there had been better regulation on opioids and there had been more resources for mental health conditions and less stigma, maybe we wouldn't have had this tragedy.
You talk about having empathy for people with mental disabilities, and you talk about your sister. We mentioned that she thought she was going to get 25 years at the most. You talked with her defender. Mm-hmm. She seemed to be competent. And then she is 25 plus, life plus 25. But strangely, you write that she has somewhat thrived in prison. Tell us about what's happened since she's been in prison and how that could possibly be.
It's a God's beautiful tapestry and his puzzle that he puts things together. Her life was so bad outside of prison that going to prison has made her a happier person. It's the first time I've seen her smile in years. She's gone back to religion, and she teaches Bible classes to the younger inmates. And well, with COVID, she hasn't gotten to do that as much, but she has turned herself around to the Lord, and, you know, she's come at peace with what she's done or what she's been involved in or what happened. We, you know, she still says she did this. So, you know, in everybody's eyes, she's this murderer, but she's happier than she ever has been. And in a sense, this crime has freed me as well of the burden of trying to help and assist them with their lives and help them with things. Because at least I know now she's in prison, but she's a lot safer than she was outside of prison. Isn't that sad? That's just the saddest part of this whole thing, is that her, with her mental health issues, she at least gets her medicine regularly, and that she does have a little bit of therapy. I mean, it's not an ideal situation, by no means. And one of these days, I'm praying that she'll get out and we can go to therapy together, and we can get her more specialized care when she gets out. But she's not getting victimized. I mean, there's other ways of victimizing in the prison, but she's not getting victimized by a man who's beating her every day and taking her medication. And she's getting her medication, and it's regular. She has to, you know, they have to make sure she gets her meds, and it's more regulated than she ever has been. And her and I are a lot closer, because it made me reevaluate me. You know, I was in a 26-year marriage, which was, but it wasn't a fulfilling marriage, and I found true happiness. So in a sense, this tragedy, if you want to bring any hope to it, has brought us closer together. I have a real sister now, where we were always, Mom had always assigned us to these roles, that Vicki was slow and that I was a smart one, and that Betty, you make sure that Vicki's doing this. And I remember being in fourth grade doing Vicki's homework. You know, Vicki was in high school. So and now I actually have a sister that I love and I can see, and I get to see her for the first time in 2 years since COVID. Since the jail's been locked down, I get to see her in a couple of days, and I get to take her Kentucky Fried Chicken, which is her big thing. Always goes back to Kentucky Fried, but I get to take her chicken, but if you know, you always got to look at the bright side. My mom used to always sing that old country song, "Keep It on the Sunny Side." That's what we do, and I tell her that, you know, in every call that she calls, and she's having problems with the guards or she's having problems with her mental health, I say, "How is your mental health? Let's talk about it." Because for so many years, the stigma and the sheer embarrassment and shame, we didn't talk about emotions. My mom didn't allow us to have emotions. We couldn't cry when we wanted to cry. We couldn't get mad when we wanted to get mad. You know, it was, but now we can. And I told her, I said, "This is a great thing. You might be behind those bars, but you're my sister and I love you." So that's the only great thing, if there is anything, that came out of this.
Yeah, it's incredible. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about this remarkable book, If You Can't Quit Crying, You Can't Come Here No More. And that was the thing that she had said to you when you first visited her and you were crying. She says, if you can't quit crying, you can't come here no more. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about this book, A Family's Legacy of Poverty, Crime, and Mental Illness in Rural America, Betty Frizzell. Is there a website or a Facebook page that people might refer to find out more about this book?
Yeah, you can go to, I have Jane Frizzell, because, you know, I'm from the South, we have two names, BettyJaneFrizzell.com, or go to Farrell House Publishing, and then in Amazon, there's a sample chapter you can see about it. But I really appreciate it. And with the crying thing, we weren't allowed to cry, so to her to see me cry and tell me she just couldn't take it, I couldn't come see her again, I had to learn how to stop again. Thank you very much for having me and sharing my sister's story.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Betty Frizzell. If you can't quit crying, you can't come here no more. Thank you so much. You have a great evening. Thank you for this interview. Good night.
Goodbye.